everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini with the Go See Talk podcast experience. Thanks for coming back to the show. Man, when you talk about bucket lists, I would have to say that Paul Hostlinger has got to be at the top of that paragon, pyramid, sphere, podium, whatever you want to call it. This premier musical wheelman, he makes music so impactful, so endearing. His guitar work can literally cut through steel. He's so in touch with the digital soundscape. I'm not even sure if he's human. I think he's pure data. He's a competent and complex series of ones and zeros that elevates any story from the ho-hum to the kick-ass. We are thrilled to invite Mr. Hostlinger to the show. Paul, how's things in your world?
Yeah, nice. Thanks for this very kind introduction. I'm still processing some of the information.
Well, your mind's like a supercomputer, so I think it's like something comes in, you put it in, and like what you're going to shoot back out is fireworks. So,
if you say so.
Well, why don't we go in the Wayback Machine? I mean, you've got a lot of toys at your disposal behind you, but what was it like growing up? What was the things that got you into music? What were some of your first steps towards this wonderful career?
Well, I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Austria, which felt like a backwater to things, really. And, you know, there was the outside world looked a lot more interesting than the surroundings that I grew up in. And part of that outside world certainly was new music, bands of all kinds, electronic music, obviously. And I'd started with piano, but very soon got attracted to the electronic side and started playing with my first little synths. Nobody could afford anything because at the time equipment was extremely expensive. That changed with the onset of home computing, specifically the Atari having MIDI ports on it. And that was really my sort of empowerment moment, you know, when you could get an Atari and then actually start producing music and making music. And when I joined Tangerine Dream, I was actually sort of the kid with the Atari at the time, you know, because they hadn't made the full switch to computer-based working yet. And I was sort of this young gun who came in and knew how to work computers and get that up to speed pretty quickly.
There are pockets of the world that are known for certain things, like Detroit was known the auto center of the world. And, you know, Vienna has a huge, rich culture in music and performance. And now Nashville is kind of like the live music capital of the world. You know, things change with time. But what was it, cutthroat in Austria? Did you have to a lot of competition? Who'd you learn from? Who supported you at a young age?
I took music theory lessons at a pretty early stage. And, you know, I was originally set on the classical path. It comes like, you know, skiing and classical music is sort of what you grew up with in Austria. I grew up in Linz, not in Vienna, but then went to study music in Vienna. And at the time already, I was leading a double life because I would go to the academy during the day and study music, but I would play in bands and as a studio musicians at night. And obviously, the band stuff and the studio stuff was where the fun was. And then the school was what I did for my parents, more or less, to keep them at bay. And I enjoyed both of it. I have to say, you know, I still enjoy learning about music that never gets old, that curiosity. And but clearly my heart was in the new stuff and what you could do with it and these possibilities. And you know, when the offer came from Tangerine Dream to go on a tour in 86 with them, I didn't have to think twice. It was a very easy decision to say, well, goodbye classical music, I'm just going to do this now, and then just roll with it. And fortunately for me, you know, they liked what I was doing, and I just ended up staying in the band for 5 years.
What was the connection? How did you two meet? What was the meet cue, as they say in Hollywood?
The meet cue was that they were looking to replace their third member, Johannes, who they had some falling out with at the time, I guess, quickly. And they had a tour coming up, and Edgar Froese had a studio near Vienna, and they were basically auditioning whoever was in the Vienna scene at the time, studio cats and live players. And I was one of those people that they auditioned. I guess I got lucky and made the cut.
I assume that getting acquainted with a group that had the gravitas, even at that time, I mean, were your eyes just as big as saucers? Would you wake up every day pinching yourself?
Yes, but I also think, I had the arrogance of youth or the ignorance of youth, and I wasn't nervous about the meeting. I basically just went into it like any other meeting. And ironically, it may be one of the reasons that got me the gig, that I wasn't, overly impressed. This was just another opportunity. It was another chance to do something. And only when we started the tour and I started playing gigs with them, did I realize, oops, this is a different category, and this opens a lot of doors that were closed before. And that's what it turned out to be, because I wouldn't have a film career today. I wouldn't have been able to do a lot of other projects had it not been for that decision by Edgar and Chris at the time to take me on.
Well, you mentioned showing them the new tricks, the new tools of the time. I guess what was their learning curve? What was your sort of what was the barrier to entry for them, and how open were the discussions you had?
It was, technology always keeps developing. There's never a point where you can rest on your laurels and not learn new things. I mean, to this day, I'm still learning new software every year. But it was a transition moment, not just for Chris and Edgar at the time, but also for the industry. Some of these software companies that write the music software were then just establishing, and a lot of them are in Hamburg or still based in Hamburg. So I would be commuting between Berlin and Hamburg and work out the early stages of synchronizing, between picture and music. And it was a whole other process, and I was sort of spearheading that process within Tangerine Dream, because they had tape machines and older ways of synchronization, but for digital synchronization, they had really nothing set up yet. And so it was a cool process for all of us. But as for the working method, we would get together and work on projects, prepare a tour or work on an album. And then at night, I was sort of left alone in Chris Franke's studio in Berlin, which was an old ballroom full of equipment and all the equipment that I could never previously afford. So I had a great time at night just roaming free in that amazing studio and trying every piece of equipment I could find in there. And the album Underwater Sunlight, which came out around that, this is the first album I worked on with them, 86. And a lot of what's on this album comes from these late night sessions where it was basically just trying out different pieces of equipment that I never had a chance to get my hands on. And now they were all there in one room and I could play with them.
That's so awesome to hear. It reminds me of a parallel. I spoke to Barry Burns of Mogwai, and he says that whenever they start a new album, they always try to get new equipment, but the key is they don't read the instructions. They like just go in and just mess with it and stuff. And so the line I'm taking is, you have bands like Mogwai and Lamontos and Air, and I think that so much of what you and Edgar did informed music today, 20, 30 years later. Have any bands have reached out to you and say, "Oh my God, you inspired me to do this," or any odd stories or odd concert experiences where somebody just like, "I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your inspiration"?
Yes, I mean, it's always gratifying to hear. It's the nicest in the context of live shows, when people come up after the live show and share that they were impressed. Lately, it's not been so much live shows, but more film composers who tell me that, it set them on a certain path or influenced the path they were choosing. Admiration is a tricky subject, because as the recipient of admiration, you also realize that half the admiration is unwarranted, right? They see you as something that you really not are, because nobody's a genius. Nobody has great ideas all the time. But even if some of it is not true, as long as it's inspirational to people, I don't care if they're misinterpreting or overestimating my contributions. Because if it enables them to do something, That's great. I'm all for it. They should use this as a launching pad and a method to get into things. And I for that, it's not really, it doesn't matter if it's factual or if it's true. It's just the effect, and the effect is very welcome for me.
Well, I'm going to give you some more claps and adulation, and just you inspired me not to make music, but to just be a voracious consumer of more electronic music and more of the work that you do.
More power to you.
You got a keyboard behind you, and if I'm not mistaken, a piano has about 12 key, there's a range of 12 notes. And you get into the digital sound space, it's literally endless. You can get so granular. How do you tether yourself to something, to, whether it's a project or a personal album? How do you keep from getting so into the creative weeds?
In my lifetime, at least, we went from a situation where there weren't enough possibilities to a situation where there's too many possibilities. And anybody who runs a computer setup and has 500 plugins every morning to choose from knows what I'm talking about. And so the first step in any project these days for me has become to limit the options, to write a little rule book for this project, what to do and what not to do, what to put in and what to leave out. And I think this has simply become a necessity. It's a change in how we create things, which was really always traditionally focused on this moment of where you think of the melody or the moment of creating something new. And this is also in part an illusion, of course, because how much new it is, we find out later. But now it's more. Think of it like a photographic technique where you're a photographer selects from a series of moments the one magic one, right? And it feels to me that a lot of creative work these days are finding these little magic moments. It has something to do with receiving and being able to receive and process and select certain combinations or certain instances. Because we are looking at a few million options. And so this ability to creatively select is one of the key talents today. I think you need to have to make something. And it's almost like it's shifted a little bit from just creator to creator slash producer. And we wear different hats all the time. If you look at other film composers, Hans Zimmer is a great producer. I think he's more a producer than he's a writer, but he has the ability to select the right combination of things for his projects. So it's a changing field, but and certainly a double-edged sword because every new plugin, every new instrument at our disposal is exciting on some level. It can itself trigger new energy, new creative energy, new ideas. But if you have 500 of them that you need to chew through in one morning, by the end of going through those 500 plugins or instruments, you're going to be so exhausted, you're not going to have any ideas anymore. So it's a balancing game, right? You need to balance the potential of excitement with your focus on the project. And that's never ending. But it's especially at the start of each project is very important to do a little bit of focusing and slim down the options for it so you come out with a consistent piece of work.
Well, the method that you describe, or the process you describe, parallels my experience on airplanes. I used to get on an airplane with so much excitement, like I'm going somewhere and I'm going to watch a movie, and I'd spend half the flight looking through all the options of what I wanted to watch. And by the time I selected something, it's like, please return to your seat backs, tray tables, the upright lot, and you're exhausted. So not a one-to-one, but I see what you're going for. So, well, why don't we talk about when you wake up in the morning? Whether it is a commission, whether it is a project, whether it is something you just need to get out of your head. I guess what's the first instrument you run to, and how do you start your process?
In most DAW is a composing software. There are templates, right? You create templates, and the templates are your starting point for your work. So for a film project, there's a different template than for a TV project, there's a different template than for a music project. And I have my own customized templates, and those are usually my starting point. And for most people working in film or TV, and with these templates, there are different philosophies. Some people like to have 2,000 tracks in their templates, with everything, the full orchestra right there, ready to play for them. And other people like to start with a blank page, right? Nothing on the page, not even an instrument track. You just build it as you go. And I'm somewhere in the middle between those two. So I like some instruments in there. A lot of people, including myself, still use piano for sketching. So there'll be a piano track up of some kind. And I can just noodle along some ideas if I have to. I also have in my offices, I always have a keyboard somewhere, you know, and it doesn't particularly matter which sound it's on or which instrument it's on, as long as I can hear pitch and play a melody or try something out, it'll do. And, you know, if the project already has a focus, or I've already worked a little bit on focusing the sound and the aesthetic for it, then I may have a customized starting point. Let's say if I decide this should be 70s synth stuff, I may just put a few typical 70s analog synth colors into my template, and those will be my starting point. So it always changes a little bit, but it's always keyword oriented.
I remember speaking to Patrick Doyle, and one time, I think it was the score to Cinderella, he was, it had a very Parisian flair to it, a French flair. And I said, well, is this based on certain modalities? Do you study, you know, composers of the time? And he goes, no, it's really my interpretation. It's kind of like what I think French music sounds like. So I'm wondering, does that maybe, if you lean onto what's expected or classical versus just trying things out of the box, do you find yourself on one way, going one way or the other?
Yes. It's an interesting example to consider, because I found very often that the lack of precise knowledge of a style, or a certain landscape for music, can enable new things. Now, there's two ways of looking at it. The one is to say, you know, a French musician may look at what Patrick did and say, well, this is wrong. You know, it doesn't follow these rules we've been living with in French musical culture for hundreds of years. But a creative way of looking at it would be to say, no, but this is more interesting, because it's free of these rules. You know, he just explores a space and a feel to the composition, rather than being technically accurate, which is sort of the problem I've always had with classical music, which is, you know, it would dictate rules to perfection. And the music that has moved me most in my life very often has been less than perfect. And it was the fact that it was less than perfect that was a big contributing factor to it. Somebody was struggling, or somebody was straining to get somewhere. These pieces often affected me more than a perfect interpretation of a Beethoven sonata. Not to say that Beethoven can't be very moving; he actually is. But it's a matter of principle, you know. And I feel that this notion of wrongly interpreting something can sometimes actually be an enabling factor in finding something new or finding something unusual, getting a new spin on things. There's also, you know, the example of Les Baxter, who is one of my favorite composers, who did in the first Exotica wave. It was an LA-based composer, and, you know, it was this wave in the 50s and 60s when people were imagining the Southern Pacific and Polynesia, and they had all these notions about this culture, which were for the most part illusions. You know, they would just imagine these people living in these islands and being free of cultural inhibitions. And he would write music for this. You know, it was a whole wave of first generation exotica. But Laz, like most of these people, had never been to any of these islands. He'd never been to this world. He was just imagining it. And the music is stunning. You know, I mean, some of the most original juxtapositions of elements and just weird assemblies of orchestras happen around that time. And they happened purely because he was imagining this world that was beyond his reach. He couldn't travel there. He didn't have the means to travel there. There were no real, you couldn't learn about the music that was practiced there because there was no musicology at the time that had documented it. Now, if you did the same thing today, you had the musicology, you could learn exactly about this music and you could make a perfect rendition of this music. It wouldn't be half as interesting as what Laz did when he was just imagining the stuff. So those are principles of creative work that you discover over time when you go like, yeah, you know, there is no clear right or wrong. It really has to be looked at from different angles, and eventually you come out with something. There's no clear rule book, there's no clear method for it, but that the unawareness of certain things under circumstances can be actually an advantage, as it was for Laz.
That's a fantastic response. Thank you so much for giving me that. I'm going to look up more of Les's work, but that I think that brings it's a perfect segue into something that I've really been wanting to speak to you about. In an interview that you gave a couple of years, maybe 10 years ago at this point, you talked about how directors and filmmakers are expecting to see a finished score, and it's tougher to get people to buy off on, say, a mock-up or just sort of bring them up to speed slowly. But if you were to show somebody a mock-up, there might be more of an unawareness or might like exploring the process of creating as opposed to, you know, giving somebody a full package right out of the gates. So, how difficult is it these days to sort of baby step your way to a score as opposed to having to know every answer right off the bat?
I think the key factor is to have time. So, you know, when I first arrived in Hollywood, I remember the customary average time for a composer to be on a project was 6 to 8 weeks. So you come in late in the post-production process and you're just accompany the post-production through its final stages to final mix. That's from my perspective today, that's a very limited time window. I prefer to come onto projects early, develop music alongside the project and have the chance for a few trial runs, both for me and for the filmmakers. Because in these trial runs, certain things will emerge that become sort of the tone of the film. And if you don't have the chance to dial it back and dial it back in, you will never get, you know, find a really cool match. And I've always compared this to building an album, because when you build an album, it's the same thing. You overproduce, you write more tracks than you need, and then you let the tracks emerge that actually form the body of the album. And when I first got to Hollywood, people were saying like, yeah, but you know, this is film score, it's not an album. And I always say, no, but it should be the same. It should be the same process. You should give music a chance to develop and establish, not just take the first or the second draft, but do a few drafts and then figure it out over time. Your judgment will change. You know, in 3 weeks, you will look at the same piece of music with completely different eyes and different ears. So that's why the key factor is to start early and to produce more material than you need. And then it depends also on your counterpart, because in this process, you will actually get different input from the filmmakers, and more than half the projects, your starting point is not your end point. You know, they will ask for something and then realize through the process that they actually want something else. And for all of this to be possible, all you need is basically a little bit of an expanded time frame. Some people like Paul W.S. Anderson, I've worked with many times now. I'm starting to work in the script stage with him, really, on music ideas and trading ideas back and forth. And that to me is the ideal case. It is becoming more common now. So I think all my recent projects had early starts where you were writing alongside the project, and more TV shows now also ask for it. They ask for a composer to come on early, and when they start post-production, they already want to temp with original score, because everybody who's been through this temp experience where they temp with third-party score, and then the composer has to chase whatever was in the temp, and it becomes sort of a compromise. But if you start temping with original score, you're already ahead and you're already working with your original material and have a much better chance to form a cohesive tone for the film or the TV show. So it's more and more common, but I've been trying to push that message for at least 15 years.
But like you said, working with Paul, there's relationships. So by going from one project to the other, you sort of find your groove. I assume that it's a lot tougher with somebody you've never met before than someone you've done five films with.
Yeah, it depends, but there's also a sympathetic principle in it, which is people select you for their projects based on previous work, right? And so fortunately, the longer I do this, the more I get selected for projects by people that appreciate the particular kind of things that I like to do. So I just finished this Amityville, an origin story series for MGM Plus. Director I'd never worked with, Jack Riccobono, and we got along just great. I came on early, first time we worked together. I didn't really know what to expect with him other than I liked his previous projects, and it worked great. We certainly didn't end with it where we started. We did a few shifts and a few adjustments, but the fact that he really appreciated my work and I really appreciated his work forms a basis on which any change is possible. If you shift or adapt, it really doesn't matter, because your overall appreciation for each other's work is there, and that carries the whole thing.
Going about what you said, you write more music than you need, and you sort of let that inform that develop the temp. I kind of want to go back to 3 o'clock High, one of my all-time favorite films, simply because of the score. And I read in the liner notes, Erez Serebian reissued the fantastic score, and I read in the liner notes that you guys, Tangerine Dream, produced music, and when it got back to Hollywood, it was not enough. So that's when Sylvester Levay came in and tried to do you in LA. So I'm curious, what was the mindset of, nowadays everything, even TV, is wall-to-wall music. So what was the idea of, them possibly needing more of your work and finding out if they didn't have it?
It was the period in which 3 o'clock High happened was a difficult one, in part because we did Near Dark almost in overlapping time. These projects were very close together, and I remember there were some issues between Edgar and the producers of that film, 3 o'clock High. And remember, Phil Joano was at the time considered a young Steven Spielberg. So he was supposed to take over Hollywood, more or less. And so he was this whiz kid who could do nothing wrong, who came in with some notions. From my today's perspective, I think it was there was bad communication on this project, where people were misunderstanding each other. Phil didn't really have a clue how to communicate with Edgar and the rest of the band, and vice versa. We certainly didn't pick up on the subtleties of Hollywood communication. So we're talking past each other on this project quite a bit. I remember we did two drafts of the score. So we did a whole first draft that was dismissed, and then we did another one that ended up being in the movie. But it wasn't straight sailing, for sure. It was a lot of back and forth and discussions. And that may explain why at some point they then just went out and got some extra music here. But yes, the main issue on this project was communication and or lack thereof. And you know, today when I look at how film scoring is taught, and I know a lot of people who teach and we're good friends, I always bring up this question, say, so how do you teach communication, you know, because this is like 30% of the gig is understanding people, you know, they say one thing but they mean another thing, and to interpret this right and also make clear to them that you understand. That's a big part of the challenge in this field. And it's hard to teach in a way, right? How do you teach communication? How do you teach understanding subtext? I mean, I'm still learning, you know, and it's almost like you need to do a side course in psychology or something, but it is tricky. It's very tricky, and more so if you're in two different locations and, you know, you now think the world is connected and it's all one big global playground. Yes. But the subtleties of communication take a while. I know, because it took me about 10 years after moving here to start understanding subtleties of language or expressions or even humor. You know, you don't get half of the jokes when you first come here. So it's interesting that to this day, I think this figuring out, you know, the subtleties of messages is tricky and difficult. And if there are creative problems on a project, this is usually a big part of it, and it certainly was for 3 o'clock High.
Well, everyone, we should thank Mr. Hosslinger for the masterclass in how to deal with people. This has been excellent. Well, I want to show you a picture. I don't know if you can see this from my phone to your screen, but do you recognize this individual in the black?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. John Stockwell.
Yes, I saw Cheaters a number of years ago, and it was like, it's an HBO film. It was late at night. I was doing an internship in Dallas, and the movie came on, and I thought I'm just going to watch a couple minutes. I was up till 3:30 in the morning. Your music, his direction, the acting, fantastic movie. What were some of your experiences on that? And that led to a 4 or 5 picture relationship with Mr. Stockwell.
Yeah, I mean, it was the usual sort of series of coincidences. And, you know, at the time, I had done quite a bit of ghostwriting in Hollywood. I first helped Chris Franke a little bit, and then I was working with Graham Revell for some years. And I had come to the attention of different people around town. But at the time, I knew the main music supervisor for HBO, a gentleman called Evian Klein. And they had this, you know, John was, I think, in his early 20s at the time. So he was not only a first-time director, he was, you know, young, inexperienced first-time director. And Evian thought that that might be a good, he knew I wanted to do something different. And I was looking to branch out on my own name. And he just put me up with John. And, you know, there were a lot of sort of hesitant voices in the room at HBO specifically, but I did a few quick demo tracks for them, and that then sort of cleared the way and set us off to run. I think it was Cheetahs was also a lucky coincidence in a way, you know, of the cast that they chose, the way he shot it. The producers he surrounded himself with, everything just worked well together on this project. And you know, over the series of following projects, it got, so the films got bigger, the numbers got bigger, the political pressure got bigger, and eventually, actually, unfortunately, took down John's career because he got lost in this process of making compromises and not wanting to make compromises, but he was in these big commercial vehicles and couldn't really keep the creative control as he liked. It's a typical Hollywood story, you know, it happens all the times, but for John in particular, It was heartbreaking for me because I thought he was such a talented guy. And as you see in Cheaters, he had the right instincts. He had the right concept of how what movies should be. And remember, at the time, HBO did mostly period pieces. They did nothing like Cheaters, and it was a real statement at the time. But it's an unfortunate part of Hollywood that a lot of good talent sometimes gets lost in these big commercial vehicles where there's a lot of pressure from the studio and from the producers to make their money back. And that's the end of a lot of good stuff.
Well, I was lucky enough to meet him at in here in Texas, in Dallas. They have a horror convention that's become a big deal across the nation called Texas Frightmare Weekend, and he was here doing signings for the, I think it was 30th anniversary of Christine. John Carpenter was here, and I just got in line, and I was like, "Mr. Stockwell, I want to show you something." He goes, "Bring that over here. I'm going to sign it." So it was a nice little see his eyes perk up. I'd like to ask you about Halt and Catch Fire. I'm a consumer, and if you track an artist's career, you might think, well, they found their groove eventually, or they found something, what they become known for over time. But it was really there all along. You mentioned being interested in electronics, and I just love the Halt and Catch Fire soundtrack. But I think that, I really have to go back to almost, your '94 album, Future Primitive. Tracks like Urban Hypnotics and Saint and Robot, there are some things that I feel like were kernels and nuggets that were extruded through the years. So I guess how do the work you do now, how is it informed by things that you had interest in earlier in your career and you've never let it go?
I didn't look at Halt and Catch Fire this way. I looked at Halt and Catch Fire in a way to do kind of a second round on some of this stuff. And part of that is certainly my dissatisfaction with some of the 80s Tangerine Dream output. I think there were good parts in there, and but there were a lot of parts that today, from today's perspective, I don't particularly like and would like to correct if I could, but I can't. Of course, they are out and they're in the open. But if you do a project like Halt and Catch Fire, then you can correct it somewhere and saying, I'm taking another swing at this, but I'm gonna leave out all the stuff that in the last 20 years has started to bother me and I think was a wrong decision at the time. I'm gonna try to leave those out, so that in another 20 years I can look back and Halt Catch Fire and say, now I'm going to leave out these and these parts. It continues, of course, but in a way, Halt Catch Fire was my attempt to pick the good parts out of this body of work in the 80s and with Tangerine Dream, and then curate it for this occasion. And as the series developed, it started as this piece about, the personal computing revolution with sort of a Texas perspective. And it was charming and interesting, and it could be fun, and it was clear they only wanted electronic score for it. But then it over the seasons it also became a character study, and you got more invested into the characters' various trajectories, and it felt to me like it developed a second sort of psychological, emotional dimension apart from the fact that it was a show about the tech industry and about people working with computers and dreaming about computers and dreamers and people who are not all the time directly connected to reality. So it was inspiring on many, many levels. I like sort of the turns it took and the expansions, because we started out with a pretty straightforward 80s approach, but then what I did over the course of the series, as the characters' story arcs expanded, you would learn more about them, you would learn more about their backgrounds and about their sort of future path, is I took the liberty on the music side to also expand the musical palette a little bit, in that I used earlier and earlier sources for the electronic sounds back to, you know, 70s and 60s stuff, but changed the processing to be more current. So there'd be nonlinear processing, granular processing, all kinds of things you didn't have in the 80s. And it felt to me to open up an interesting tension to use old sound generation, but very new processing. It tears at the seams of the music a little bit. And this is what most of the characters were also going through, you know, where they tried to make peace between their past, their biographical past, and their future. And of course, it's impossible. You can never find a balance for this. You struggle your life long to understand it and to cope with it, but you can't make peace between these two sides. You know, they will always pull apart. So it was. It seemed to work well. And then in the fourth season, we really some of this cues were in a strictly psychological or also irrational space. And I'm pretty happy with, you know, what the show achieved in this arc. And the shelf life of the show also proves it. You know, it's one of the shows that comes up and people would comment and keep commenting about it, you know. I think only Underworld, the Underworld series, is another project that I did that had a similar staying power, you know, where people just, in Underworld's case, they identify with the main character, Celine, and that becomes its own universe for people, and they stick with it. And it's similar for Halt, Catch Fire, where it just doesn't go away. 80% of projects just go away, you know, and a few will just stay for whatever reason, and Halt and Catch Fire is definitely one, and certainly one of my favorites.
Well, it's one of my top two favorites of all time. House MD and Halt and Catch Fire. There's just something to those characters and the music behind it. Phenomenal. But when you said that music will never go away, do you now get into a situation where you come into a project and the movie or TV show is temped with your music? And you have to get back into that mindset of like, what was I doing then? Or, you know, how do I replicate that?
Yeah, I've never hated temp tracks, because it's always something you can learn from temp tracks. Even if it's wrong, you know, you learn that it's wrong and you learn that that doesn't work. So I don't mind when people tempt my stuff or use that as a starting point. Preferably, as mentioned before, you know, you come on early enough in the project that what they're starting to temp with is already original material. You're setting your chances of success, if you define success as being original, are much higher if you start with original material than with pre-existing temp. But you know, the positive side of this awareness is that the number one reason why you get hired as a composer is because of a previous project. You know, it's not the agent, it's not your publicity, it's not any of the other stuff. It's basically somebody watching Halt and Catch Fire, really enjoying it, and then saying, who did the music for this? I want that guy. So the biggest effect that the good projects have for us is they generate 10 years of additional work because of their effect. So that's really the other side of their importance. And the best career move that you can make is just get lucky and get on one of those projects.
Well, I mean, I think the work of like The Perfection and The Dirt, Titan AE, I know you helped that on, those movies speak for themselves. And so, like you're saying, that helps you get the next job. But if we can go back in time a little bit, can you share some of the stories working with Graham Revell? I mean, I'm not sure if you can see this. There's a Saint pin on my lapel. And I know that that was just before your time working with him. But I do have to say that his piano theme on that is probably my favorite theme in all of film music. So, what was the process working with him on the Titan A.E. and Negotiator?
I was introduced to Graham by a good friend, mutual friend of ours called Brian Williams, who goes by the name of Lustmord as an artist. It was, I think, I met Graham and we just both understood each other immediately, simply because he was not a traditional musician. You know, he played in industrial bands before, and he had a pretty wide perspective on music, as do I, and so we appreciate each other's you know, looking for unusual things and looking for things that don't exist yet. And in Graham's case at the time, he got really loaded up with work and he was feeling this effect. You know, a lot of composing and scoring work is a lot of detailed programming and long hours in front of the computer, and it was getting a little overwhelming for him. So he was looking for someone who could work on his level and take off some of this load. And the most extreme case of this was when we did Tomb Raider. It was the I think we were the fourth composer team on that project. They had fired three other teams before, and we had about 2 weeks to do it, like to replace the entire score on Tomb Raider. And then there was this, they tried to get a PG rating, and the requirement for them to get that PG rating was that they had to reduce violence. And the way they defined the reduction of violence, that on, you know, the fighting scenes, instead of sound effects on the hits and the punches, you had musical effects instead of actual effects. And so I was the poor schmuck who had to then go in and basically score these action scenes in a way that every single punch in the scene had a musical hit or a swell or something else on it. And it sounds horrible, but it was actually a ton of fun to do it because it was sort of like a math puzzle. You know, you had to figure it out with the keys and with the tempos. And we got it done and we delivered this in the 2 weeks that were allotted to us with parallel orchestra recordings in London. It was truly crazy, but in hindsight, of course, it was a lot of fun. And you go like, yeah, that was worth doing. And to just sort of as a bottom line, I think again, between Graham and me, there was just a high level of respect. Same sense of humor, seeing sort of the funny sides in these crazy schedules and what's going on, and also kind of a commitment to, you know, so what if you have to go through the nights or, do a few extreme things along the road, that's all fine, you know, because that's why we chose this field over, I don't know, working in a bank or selling groceries or something. You know, it comes with certain features that are a little bit unusual and at times chaotic, but you know, life could be boring, could be much worse. So we both really embraced it and enjoyed it. And even though I was sort of in a ghostwriting position with him and wasn't sort of officially doing anything, it still exposed me to the machine in Hollywood. I was at the recording sessions. All the executives saw me in action, and it was a big part of landing Cheaters and getting an agent. All this was based on the fact that I had worked for a few years with Graham and was in circulation. You know, I would be in all the studios. I would be from the recording to the mix sessions. And people take note. They see who's doing what, and they say, who's that kid? It was a big I think the Tangerine Dream credit was good, but at the time, which is the 90s, electronic really wasn't what it is today. You know, it was actually more of a curse word at the time. Today, if you say Tangerine Dream, everybody's, you know, falling over backwards. But at the time, Tangerine Dream was not a hot topic. It wasn't really a credit. Working with Graham Revell was at the time, you know, and it really opened more doors for me at the time than the Tangerine Dream credit did.
I have to ask a funny question. So now that you've got used to hitting certain beats, you know, for action and comedy effect to bring down the rating, do you ever use that now to when your name comes up in the opening credits to sort of punch up the theme, you know, give yourself a little acoustic lift whenever you are in the main titles?
No. I mean, if you do anything, it's sort of a sport with composers to do something funny, you know, on the composer credit, like either
Okay.
put a bad sound, you know, an out of tune trumpet or something like that, you know, you often put on the credits. But you know, more often than not, I don't even, because everything's so last minute these days, I don't even know where the credits are and how they're placing the credits. It's fewer and fewer productions that will actually do an actual credit sequence, you know, and so it always depends. But I remember on Vacancy, there's like a 5 minute end credit section, and this was the only project where, and I did it as a joke, obviously, to where I in the end credits, was a 5 minute piece variation of the opening theme. I did score all the different departments, and I gave everybody their little funny out of tune sound effect or something, and it was very appreciated when we played it through on the final mix. But you know, for most people who watch the movie, they don't even see the end credits, so it's a bit of a waste of time.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that this conversation has not been a waste of time. Mr. Hosslinger, it has been an absolute pleasure. As I mentioned, a bucket list opportunity. You've been a hero of mine. So to take us out, if you want to tell us what you're working on and maybe drop, maybe what's the first album you ever bought?
Ooh, first album I ever bought. I can honestly not remember. I can tell you the first band that I saw live, which was Jethro Tull. And I remember, you know, I think it was maybe like 13 or 14. And I thought my overriding thought was, I didn't know you could do that with a flute. But yeah, I mean, it looks pretty quaint looking back at that. But so up and coming stuff, this docu-series I just did for MGM Plus about the Amityville origin story is opening this Saturday, I believe, MGM Plus. And it's a four-part series, and it sheds some light on the backgrounds of the Amityville phenomenon. Including some very funny interviews with witnesses from the time, but also people like John Carpenter. They're interviewing about, you know, the business of horror films and the business of horror telling. And just the John Carpenter bits are worth watching the show, honestly. He's extremely funny. But also, you know, the 70s in New York were a very interesting time period. And the director's approach when he first talked to me was to say, you know, I want to paint a cultural portray of the city around that time. That's really my main ambition with this project. That's what really interested me on this, and I saw this as an opportunity. Peter Baumann contributed a little bit to it, who I love working with. So it was a nice project to spend some time with, and I'm pretty happy with the way it's come out, how it balanced the final mix. So that's starting on Saturday. Then on in June, July, another documentary about YouTube that Alex Winter did and I worked on about a year ago is finally coming out in theaters. It's been playing festivals for a year or so. So it starts theatrically, and then I think it starts streaming in August. It's called The YouTube Effect. And again, I would recommend watching that. It's very timely, you know, the talk about social media and the effects it has are analyzed and laid out in great detail with the example of YouTube. And then I started working on In the Lost Lands, which is the next Paul W.S. Anderson project. That will come out only in 2024, but we're already working on it. Involves a lot of CGI, so it's, again, a long production phase, long development phase for the music. Peter Baumann is also with me on this one. I don't want to say too much because, you know, projects often change and take different tracks, but I would say for anybody who's enjoyed the previous outings that we had, this will be a step up and should certainly deliver on a lot of points.
Mr. Haslinger, thank you so much. Everyone, check out all those projects Paul has been touting, and we will catch you next time.